session number 30304.
Said reel 3. Can I ask a little bit more about the kind of lectures that you were doing? What kind of depth they were going to at that stage?
At ITW. Well, physics, various laws, maths, basically concerned with direction, distance, ratios, meteorology, basic weather patterns, the difference between northern and southern hemisphere patterns, the movements relating to cyclones and anticyclones, the type of weather to be expected from the different systems, cyclones or anticyclones, the effect of wind on tracks and course, the difference between a course and a track, and administration, equivalent ranks. It was important that we knew. It seemed a bit silly, but you know, in case you had to, as a sergeant, salute a colonel or somebody, something like that. It's supposed to in the other, more often in the omission than the commission, I think. Then the types of units throughout the service. The setup of groups, wings, squadrons, flights, that kind of thing. I'm afraid that's all basic. But
did you do kind of a basic navigation as well? Was there any of that involved at that stage?
Well, yes. There was, of course, navigation. I should have mentioned that as a separate subject. But within what I had just previously mentioned, the maths and the physics and the meteorology and so on, I was combining really to think of navigation in that sense, track and course and so on, range and point of no return and so on. But the subject matter, for quite a time I did keep quite a few notebooks, but you know, as time goes on you think, well, we've got to dispose of some of these things, so it's a pity I didn't really.
And how is your day structured?
At ITW? Well, it was mostly to begin with drill. The point was, and of course we didn't realize it, but even at a lowly ranking as a sergeant, there were duties, and they became aware of, we became aware of them during the administrative lectures, and that a sergeant would have to do, whether he was air crew or not, when you got on an operation or a training unit, for that matter. So that originally we couldn't see the point, or didn't want to see the point. We were busy with other things in drilling, but as basic drill is applicable throughout the entire armed forces, no doubt that with foresight there should be something done, and was done, I think, to make us realise that we may be a heterogeneous group at some time in our careers. So that, and of course, it was likely, although we didn't think of it at the time, we were just pilots as far as we were concerned. But as did happen, and we began to see when we reached flying units that there was a way up through the hierarchy. And there were people who had reached the rank of squadron leader, having entered the RAF through Halton as a boy apprentice. My wife's father was one of them. He was a wing commander when he retired and went through the war in maintenance. So that was basically what we were about, I think.
And is there an element there of when you first get involved with something like the initial training wing, that you don't understand the scope and size of an organisation like the RAF, and that this is the introduction that you get to it in a step manner, so you don't always quite understand what you're doing and the reasons for doing it?
Yes, I think there's a large element of that. And you quickly accept, and I think we all those I was friendly with, accept the fact that although there are anomalies, there are gaffes made, there are some stupid lecturers, but what we were doing was coherent so far as the ultimate aim was concerned. And I think by the time we reached EFDS stage, most people had realized that. And it was a good way of doing it.
I mean, it's probably an obvious question, but I take it everybody was keen to start flying.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, yes. I mean, that was really all it was about in the early days, really. We were just biggles.
Was there any frustration at this period during the initial training wing, or did you come to terms with that there was processes that you had to do before you could fly?
Well, I think certainly I was so involved, not only in what we were doing, but also in Cambridge, whether it would have been the same out in the open country or even somewhere like Blackpool. It definitely wouldn't have been the same had it been Blackpool. I knew Blackpool well. But, you know, Cambridge just had something for me, because, for one thing, my paternal grandparents came from the Cambridge area, Fordham and Frecknum. I remember before the war, I always used to cheer Cambridge when the boat race was broadcast on the radio, so I did have feelings for the place. And there was so much to do and see. So I can't say that I was bored or anything. I was, obviously we were all very pleased when we moved on, particularly by that time as most of the people of Cambridge seemed to be friendly. And we marched we marched down to the station and yeah.
How long had it been before your uniforms had arrived?
Ah, well, now that's difficult to say. If you asked 100 bods, you'd get 100 different answers. It came in bits and pieces, in the sense that the stores, which of course involved quite a march or a walk, depending on how many of you went. It used to be that if there were four or five of you having to go down to stores, I forget where it was now, one of the colleges, and you would kind of march down. But if it was just yourself or a couple, you'd saunter down. They seem to have batches of part of uniform which would fit some of the chaps, but not others. So you would find that on parade next morning, there may be some with RAF trousers on, but still the same tops. And vice versa, some with tops, even displaying their sergeant stripes on with whatever kind of trousers they'd been wearing, and caps, which forage caps, of course, were all we were issued at that stage, at different angles, and again different sizes, so some almost covered the face, others just sort of perched on top, and we were a very motley crew.
Did you have any problems, because you're tall, did you have a problem with issues of equipment at that stage?
Only in the sense that I had to wait some time. Probably, I think my legs are longer than most. Even for my height, I was fit. I think I got my top. Did we call it a blouse? I don't know.
Were you wearing a blouse, or would it be a tunic at that stage?
No.
Because the blouse would have been quite short, wouldn't it?
Yes. No. Well, I've got a photograph somewhere. No, it doesn't matter. I think I got my top part before the trousers. But eventually, by the first leave anyway, I was complete.
Were there any arrangements for adjusting the uniform that you were issued with? Obviously, if it didn't quite fit, or would you have to do that yourself?
It didn't happen so far as I was concerned. I know some chaps had adjustments made, but I don't know how that happened. I wasn't aware of a seamstress sitting in the stores waiting for somebody to be measured and attended to.
And can I ask at this stage, obviously you're a pilot under training. Did you have any personal preferences as to the type of aircraft that you would like to fly at that stage?
Not really, because I didn't know where I would eventually end up, in the sense of whether it would be multi-engine or single-engine. Didn't know that until the end of the EFTS course, really. I began to realize I began to realize quite early that it would be unlikely that I would be suitable for a Spitfire or a Hurricane, unfortunately, in my view at the time, because obviously that would be everybody's dream, really. because of my size, and I don't like being in an enclosed small space anyway, and even if I could have got in, I don't think I would have been happy in a small cockpit, and certainly that's what I found even when I flew the Magister. That's one thing about the tiger moth. I mean, it was fairly roomy. So, no, I hadn't decided at that stage. And, of course, I didn't know anything, really, about the Hudson. Very few of us did, because the aircraft that was most comparable to the Hudson was the one that Chamberlain flew to Munich in. It was the Hudson something or other, which was a slightly smaller version of the Hudson, which was being designed as an airliner. So I didn't have a choice in mind.
Initially, had you wanted to be, say, a fighter pilot when you before you obviously you were aware of the sizes of the aircraft and that sort of thing? Was that the case amongst most pilots at that time, that would be what their preference would be?
I don't know, and I'm not sure in my own case. There you are with a tiger moth, and you're flying a tiger moth. You're happy with that. Why worry about what's next on the list, sort of thing, you know?
You left Cambridge in November, is that
yes.
Right? At that stage, were you given leave at that point, then?
I think so. Yes.
What was the next stage after that? Where were you posted to?
Well, as I say, we marched up to the station in Cambridge, or down to it, as it was down a slight slope, I think. We gave an army officer, I remember, a whole bulk of us, a sharp eyes left, and it took him by surprise. We got on this train, went into, I forget which station it was now, but into the London station. And so we knew that we were going somewhere to an EFTS in the south of England, because nobody told us. It was one of those early beliefs that there was a spy around every corner and nobody should say anything about anything which somebody might pick up and somehow pass on to the enemy. So we were under sealed orders and under control of a corporal, I think it was, on the train. A transport, you know, they had these transport officers and staff and so on. We were then taken to Paddington. I remember the journey across London, in which was being prepared for likely attack by that time. There was a reduction in traffic, and most of the vehicles were either London Red or brown military vehicles. The point was, we went to Waterloo, and everybody cheered because we knew that if we were going to White Waltham, which is the other likely FTS, we would be going to Paddington. And White Waltham had Magisters, you see, and we knew Fair Oaks
Tiger Moth.
Yes. So we were quite bucked. So we got off at Woking, and then got in a lorry to Fair Oaks Aerodrome, which is just on the north side of Woking, and the Tiger Moths were waiting.
What was the first thing that happens when you arrived at Fair Oaks? Is it the same kind of procedure that you've gone through at Cambridge? Is it accommodation and feeding, that
yes.
sort of thing?
Yes, only quite different in the sense that Fair Oaks was a pre-war reserve air training centre, much like Barton was for Manchester. And so accommodation was at a minimum there. And a number of large mansions, I suppose, rather than houses we would call them, had been commandeered sufficiently to accommodate this intake of what was number one war course for Fair Oaks Airfield. So the first thing we had to do, get off the lorry, or whatever, I think it was a lorry, and take our stuff, kit bag and the rest of it, up a long drive off the main road, which, well, not a main road, but a road which passed the entrance to the aerodrome, on the opposite side of the road, up a long muddy lane to a place called Stanners Hill, which was a large mansion, and we went up the drive, and somebody knocked on the door, probably the corporal, and no, it wouldn't be the corporal then, because he had left us at the station. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Somebody knocked on the door, and somebody else, I imagine, saw us through the window and said, "Go round to the tradesman's entrance." And so we did, and went up the back stairs up to bedrooms we were shown, which was quite pleasant, really. It's just the distance it was from the airfield that's the trouble. We had, again, three to a room, but with proper beds. Iron bedsteads, mind you, and probably straw palliasses, but they were better than sleeping on the floor, I must admit. And then back down to the mess hall, which is quite a small place, and for a meal. And that was the first day, well, first evening, actually. And it wasn't much fun, because this was the approach of winter, and this potholed road up to the digs had to be traversed at least twice a day. We got a meal at the in the mess hall down on the airfield, but it did leave quite a lot to be desired. So there we were.
How did the flying training start?
Well, you mean in terms of what we were doing when we... First of all, there was a ground inspection. You go round the aircraft and the... I mean, we knew all these things, of course, but it's all got to be done in case somebody came who didn't. The various control surfaces and that kind of thing, what the aircraft is made of, where the main spars are, petrol tankers, which, of course, on a Tiger Moth is above, and there's a little indicator to show fuel level. we would be shown the inside first before getting in. Of course, I should have mentioned the engine. The propeller and so on, the fact that it's not wise to get within the circumference of the propeller's movement when it's going, and so that kind of thing. But in the cockpit, we'd be shown inside before getting in and the way to get up onto the steps. I mean, not a step as such, but the parts of the wing that you can step on and are braced against the weight to get into the cockpit. The pupil is in the back cockpit to start. Well, it was. I don't know whether it's always the procedure or not. To begin with, so that you see the that you actually see that the controls are the same in the front cockpit as they are in the back, and there's nothing funny that the instructor can do other than you can do the same thing, and then go around. not all the aircraft will be doing the same thing at the same time, of course, because you didn't want everybody taking off simultaneously. So some may be taking off already, whilst we are still doing the checks and so on, or being given an insight into what is going to happen on the first circuit. Before that, we were shown the way to taxi the aircraft, remembering the important point that on a Tiger Moth there are no brakes. So you've got to judge your stopping distance pretty keenly according to the type of landing material on the ground. I mean, grass, long grass, is quite different to short grass, and similarly compares poorly with a concrete surface. It's a job to stop a... Not a job, really, but, I mean, it's obvious that you need to be much more qui vive if you land a Tiger Moth on a concrete surface than if it's on a grass surface. So we... and the way to taxi and so on.
Could you explain that to me? How you actually taxi the Tiger Moth?
I see. You mean using the rudder and the fin, tail fin. Well, in taxiing, the Tiger Moth will tend to bounce a little unless you keep the joystick back, pulled back into your tummy, because that will depress the elevators at the back. I think I'm right there. I've got to think about this. Stick forward. That means you get more... Yeah, that's right. Stick back is reducing the... I think we better start that bit again.